This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This week, we're resharing one of our favorite episodes of the Single Treks podcast. If you've already heard this one, don't worry, because next week we'll be back with an all-new show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Single Treks podcast. My name is Jeff, and today my guest is Dylan Rinn. Dylan is the lead coach at A Single Trek Mind, where he teaches mountain bike skills to riders of all abilities. He's been gravity racing since 1994 and served as the head coach for two high school mountain bike teams. Dylan is based in Truckee, California, near Lake Tahoe. Thanks for joining us, Dylan.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Jeff. I'm glad to be here.
So what attracted you to gravity sports and racing initially?
Story probably goes back to high school. I used to race Nordic skiing as a kid, ran cross country in high school, and never had a great alpine experience with skiing. I started alpine skiing in like early 90s. And then I went from there and realized that going downhill was really, really fun and started to definitely look out more gravity sports. And that's sort of when downhill really started taking off. And I basically got in then. I used to race on my old Lightspeed IBED or OBED. It was a old AMP version FSR frame. And I used to go high posting and I would get heckled all the time.
That's awesome. So, I mean, I guess you must have been pretty young when you started. High school racing is big now, but it wasn't big back then, right?
Yeah, no, there was no such thing as high school racing. First mountain bike would have been 89. I was probably 11 years old at that time, and I broke that one and then went out. And my first bike was a Marin Bear Valley. And then, yeah, I got one of the first Santa Cruz hecklers in 94, and that was a long travel bike. It, like, 4 inches, 100 mils of travel. We were so excited.
I bet. So how did you learn how to, race those kinds of bikes and to get into gravity riding? What did you do to become a better rider back then?
Back then I did nothing. I had no idea what I was doing. I just followed the older guys that were there and followed them. My first time of like really actually understanding riding was probably in like 2008 or 2009. And, I'd already been through that, had a pro license and yada, yada. And I started out thinking, God, it'd be really cool to start teaching. I should take a lesson. And I took a lesson and I was blown away by what I did not know.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, that's a long time to be sort of wandering around on your own, 94 to 2008.
Yeah.
14 years of, did you have sort of bad habits? I mean, what did you learn from that first class that you took?
I think the biggest thing I took away from it was like just where you are on the bike and actually thinking about it. I was that sort of hunt and peck. I had, friends that were fast and groups of riders that I would ride with, and they'd give you some tidbit here and there, like the best was like, well, if you didn't keep crashing, you'd probably win. I was like, well, that's pretty obvious. Thanks. It's that sort of stubborn teenager. But I would say it was just how the body works on the bike and understanding that you are in control was probably the biggest thing.
Yeah, that's good. Well, let's get into some tips. So, bike parks are becoming more and more popular all over the world. So walk us through some of the tips you might offer somebody who's trying to ride downhill for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on the rider itself. But like, with bike parks and the varying terrain you get there, I mean, it's... I would say it's the same as any sort of, park-esque thing. The biggest thing is know where you're going, right? Pay attention in a bike park and don't get yourself in over your head at first. Mm-hmm. And then as far as like riding tips goes, it's back to basics, really. It's just thinking you're out there for a long day. Try to be as efficient as possible. Riding smooth is really good. Thinking about where your balance is, thinking weight in the feet. I mean, that's a classic, but weight in the feet. And then thinking about looking ahead, being prepared. and just paying attention to your surroundings, stuff can come up really fast in a park. And there's also lots of people out there. So,
yeah. What are some of the drills that you would go through with someone? I mean, what's interesting is downhill is, I mean, it's almost like, it's like alpine skiing, you know, like people will have never biked before, never mountain biked before. And they, you know, see a bunch of rental bikes at a resort and say, hey, that looks like fun. I think I'll give that a try. So what would you say to someone who's doing that for the first time? What's like step one?
If it was the first time out there and they're getting out there, I'd basically have them ride around in the parking lot, right? And be like, okay, you know, here's how you stop first, right?
So yeah, that's key.
Here's your brakes. And then I'd basically just have them try to stand up and like stay in what's sort of known as the attack position or offensive position, however you want to think of it. But, you know, level pedals with a bend of the ankles, hinged at the knees, hinged at the hips with a slight bend to your arms. And then I'd work them through a range of motion so that, you know, they can understand where they are in the bike. You know, and then with braking is explaining that your front brake is actually your friend, and then getting them comfortable with using their front brake so they can have better control in that steeper stuff.
Yeah, that's interesting. A lot of people, beginners especially, are told, you know, to avoid the front brake like at all costs because you don't want them to do an endo. But
yeah,
the front brake is actually really important, especially when you're going downhill, right?
Yeah, it fully is. I mean, it's one of the things I always try to get into people's head is that you have to trust it. And it's always a fear, you know, everyone thinks, oh, I'm going to flip over and die. But there's a whole lot of other pieces that sort of play into that flip over and die model. So it's not just the front brake that happens to be applied.
Yeah, right. Like body position, I imagine, has a lot to do with that. Like how you're leaning over the bars or how you're leaning back, right?
Yeah, totally. You know, if you think that if you're too far forward, yeah, there's weight in the handlebars. So any force there is going to push you forward because you're already forward. And then the actual opposite happens is that if you're all the way back, you've reduced traction. But if there's anything there and you don't have a way to slow your body down, your body's actually accelerating the whole time. Your bike's decelerating and you're getting thrown forward still. So it's interesting how the similar opposites of balance create a similar action, even with a lot of other things as far as, you know, the other part where everyone wants to learn how to jump. And that's a whole nother story to go into.
Well, yeah, you were saying earlier too, how you let people know that they shouldn't just let the bike take them down the trail, right? Like you're in control of the bike. So talk a little bit about that. Like, how does that work as far as riding downhill?
Well, I think with downhill, the biggest thing is it's a quote I use a lot is you want to go for a ride. You don't want to get taken for a ride.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so like mountain biking itself is an offensive sport. You can't be passive in it. It's going to be driven from your body. And if you are just sort of lazy or tentative with it, you're going to get taken for a ride. But if you can get in a position that you can drive the bike and make sure that you're thinking about movement of the bike coming from your body, it's a much better sort of visual to think of. My biggest thing, I think, for downhill and descending, especially when you get into parks that may have more rough terrain, is just thinking about what your feet are doing. You know, classic standing on it, you sort of have this movement of foot pattern that creates, the IMBA and other people, they call it a wedge. But you basically have a heel drop out of your front foot and a toe point from your back foot that creates this sort of, you know, picture a wedge pushing against two sides,
mm-hmm.
which is great for staying in sort of flatter, you know, terrain, staying balanced on the bike in normal conditions. But you get into rougher terrain where the bike is slowing down unexpectedly, you need to have a bracing foot sort of set up or where your front foot is already sort of planted. But if you can think about consciously kind of driving your back heel down, you set yourself up to push the bike through any obstacle that, that might slow the bike down instead of the bike slowing down and then you rotating around that sort of natural pivot point of your bottom bracket. You can push the bike through by bracing with that sort of back heel down and that forward foot.
Yeah. And is that, I mean, is that only for descending? And also, is that only something you're able to do with flat pedals, or could you do it clipless, and does it apply to like flat pedaling or riding uphill?
Well, it can actually. I mean, it has a bunch of different purposes, you know, not, let alone just that. I mean, that's one of them. You think that your movement really comes from your feet as far as, you know, sort of where your body goes. And there's other parts to it that are movement, you know, movement based. But I think that dropping the heels in descending is more so for rougher terrain. It's not as needed for, say, a, you know, a slow trail park run. But there's also lots of other instances where you're going to drop the heels. You could drop it. It's done for manual. It's done for braking. It's done for just movement of your hips forward and backwards. You know, if you point your toes, the opposite movement happens where you actually move the hips forward. Mm-hmm. So it's a big piece for it. As far as with clipless or flats, it's definitely easier with flat pedals because the foot position usually moves more midfoot with flats.
Yeah.
And it seems that a lot of people riding clipless tend to either come from a road background or have just been riding clipless for so long that their ideas is that, you know, it's a pedaling efficiency and clipless pedals are the only way that you can pedal efficiently. And so I want to have my cleat way close to my toes. And,
right.
You know, that way I can incorporate all of these extra muscle groups and I can pull up on the backstroke. And yeah, it really doesn't help, but you can totally do it with clipless pedals. It just seems to be a little harder to support yourself.
Yeah.
if the cleats are really far forward.
Right.
And that's one of my big things that I try to get people to do is if you are riding clipless is move the cleat further back. There's a couple clipless mountain bike shoes out there right now that are actually moving the possible cleat location up to 15 millimeters further back than usual. So,
wow.
I think the ideal pedal position for me, and I think a lot of people kind of go with that, is you're thinking like pedal axle is around, you know, a centimeter behind the ball of the foot, or at least behind the ball of the foot, so that you have an athletic standing, foot position.
That's really helpful. So yeah, I like too how you said that you should really think about riding a bike. You should think about driving the bike. I mean, we're used to, that's the word we use is ride, but
yeah,
you don't really want to just hop on the bike and let it take you where it wants to go. You're the driver. You're deciding where it goes. And another thing I've heard a lot is that you want to separate your body from the bike's motion. So that's something that I tend to have a problem with, you know, coming from more of a cross-country trail background where, you know, you want to open your stance up and you want to be able to like move the bike underneath you, but keep sort of your body positioned straight, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's sort of in the beginning, you know, as far as that basic balance, right? So that's sort of the base of it is that the body position, starting with that hip hinge that everybody talks about, is sort of setting you up to have separation. Center of mass is a common word that's thrown out there. You want to think that your center of mass is where all the movement is coming from, right? So your, you know, hips up to shoulders, the larger portion of your body, your arms are an extension of that, and the legs are an extension of that. So you have those two points, and that's I think where your absorption or suspension really takes place, is in that, not in the bike itself.
Yeah.
The advantage of the park bikes is that you're dealing with extra 8 inches of travel, right? But those are just an extension of your real suspension, you know? So your body is just that key component to keeping contact with the ground or absorbing that contact or input from the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really interesting way to think about it. Enduro racing is another form of mountain biking that's becoming really popular these days. So what are some skills that enduro racers need that maybe cross country or trail riders might not have?
I think a big one is the mental side of it, is sort of stepping away from, you know, the pieces of riding harder or climbs or, you know, or separating the actual ride into components where, you know, a cross country race it's a race. That's your one purpose, is go as fast as you can for X amount of miles or hours or whatever it is. But where enduro is that it's a super mental game, you know, of trying to, you know, keep your body recovered enough to have the energy to sort of throw down when you need to.
Yeah.
As far as skills go, like trail riders, it really depends on what your hometown trail is. You know, there's plenty of skilled riders out there that probably have the skill for a lot of enduro, but I think it comes down to is realizing what your terrain, local terrain is, and what your race courses are. For cross country riders, it's just getting in that mindset, I think, of you know, it's not on all the time, that you can rest on your ascents. You can rest on your transfers. It's not, you don't have to pedal always, always, always. And I think for trail riders, it's probably pretty similar too. As far as like, you know, skills go, average, you know, average, enduros are downhill based, right? So, you know, cornering is a huge one, right? I think, I mean, really cornering goes into everything. If you can't corner, you can't go fast. It was the classic motocrosses. It's corner for dough and straights are for show, right? So it's, you know, cornering is your quintessential skill pretty much for any discipline out there.
Extra
for enduro, I think, is just, I mean, physical training, is getting strong enough to maintain your form for, you know, upwards of 7 stages. So you're racing for a long period of time.
Yeah, that's one of the thing I think that cross country riders and trail riders too maybe would underestimate for enduro is, you know, when you're riding cross country, like you said, you view the downhills as sort of a time for recovery, but you actually need a ton of energy for that. I mean, if you're feeling tired, you're not going to descend very well, right?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. You know, if you were to run a heart rate monitor on me, like my climbs would be at, you know, 120, 110, you know, I would be resting the whole time. And then in the descents, you know, I'm taxed. I'm at 180, 170, you know, for,
wow,
for like 7 minutes, right? It's not like, oh yeah, that was the old, oh, well, you're a downhiller. You're not really riding a bike anymore. Yeah. And it's like, well, you know, yeah, you are. I mean, look at the last World Cup result, right? Martin comes out off an EWS win and then handles everybody in a World Cup downhill race. Like, yeah, I mean, those guys have skill. So,
yeah,
you know, and it's different too, because the enduro race is sort of throw everything at you. It's not like, okay, here's a gnarly downhill track. Yeah, you'll have a gnarly downhill track, and then you'll have, you know, a 14-minute somewhat flat pedal stage where you have to have that sort of, you know, physical and mental fortitude to be able to push through that. So,
yeah. Well, one of the things too about enduro, a lot of the courses, you're riding them sort of sight unseen. I mean, you don't know exactly what the trail's going to throw at you. So what are some tips that you give people in terms of like vision on the trail, like looking ahead and reacting to obstacles in the trail?
Yeah. So vision, I mean, vision's your, you know, sort of, I joke, there's three things that are important with mountain biking, and safety's fourth. Right. So number one is having fun. And then number two and three are sort of interchangeable with vision and body position. If you don't have good body position, then you're not going to have good vision, because you're not going to be set up to be looking ahead. The idea with vision is you want to be thinking you're 2 steps ahead, right? Mm-hmm. I've hear further a lot, look further down the trail, further down the trail. Yeah. Further is good to a point. You don't want to go too far though.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, descending wise, like if I'm in my attack position, I'll be standing, my peripheral vision, I'll be able to see my hands. Like I don't want to be able to see my feet. Mm-hmm. Per se, in my, you know, like,
yeah,
like my good descending position. And that gives me a good view of, you know, where my front wheel is, where my hands are, sort of what my control is. Mm-hmm. And then once I start getting out and going on trail, like I basically tell people, you know, of course, look where you want to go. Mm-hmm. You know, reason being is you go where you look. If you're looking at that tree and telling yourself, don't hit that tree, your mind filters out, don't. And all you see, all you hear or see is hit that tree.
Yeah.
Right. So thinking about imaging one, where you want to go, and visualizing what your next step is. It's really common, especially in blind sections of trail, to get hung up on something and sort of like tunnel out where you can only see that one obstacle.
Yeah.
And you have to let go of that obstacle. There was a stage in China Peak race that I just did out here, stage 5, we were sitting at the top of it, and it was, you know, the banter at the top was like, well, I hope I live through this one. You know, it was a pretty gnarly stage, and it's unfortunate because it's one of those that I would have loved a couple years back, but I just haven't put myself in, you know, that sort of situation for a long time. Mm-hmm. But I came around this corner, I went straight into it. I was so focused on that part that I fully tunneled out. I got into it. I got to the bottom of it.
Yeah.
And then I realized that the trail's going to the right. Like, and I'm already to the right turn. And I'm like, I just totally locked myself out and got so hyper-focused on making it through this one section and seeing all the things that were going on there.
Yeah.
That I didn't progress my vision to the next step. And I basically stopped my bike, got off, got back on and rode the other direction. I was like, well, there goes a couple seconds there.
Yeah.
So it's difficult. And it might mean, you know, unfortunately slowing down enough so that you have enough reaction time. And to take it back a couple steps is like, how do you improve your vision? And it's really sort of challenging. I think that's like one of the biggest battles out there is having that vision. And it's just consciously thinking about looking at the terrain and riding what you want to ride instead of just looking at the trail and seeing that you have, you know, a 16 inch to 3 foot wide trail mm-hmm. that you're rolling down, that you have a choice of where you can go and what you're doing on the trail. So I think for me, that's the biggest with vision. It's just being conscious of you have a 2 inch tire and you can ride wherever you want. And if you don't look at it, you're not going to see it. So,
right. Yeah. I mean, how does that work though? I mean, is it just that your bike can roll over a lot of things that you don't think it can, or are you actually like sort of steering where you know that you need to be, if that makes sense? Like, are you kind of like predicting where your vision is like a step ahead of like what your body is actually doing? Or is it just that you don't need to worry about a lot of stuff? You're going to go over it.
It's a mix of both, I think, right? Where the modern bikes are pretty stunning, you know, is what they can do. I've definitely ran over stuff that I'm like, oh God, here we go. And then I'm like, oh cool, I made it. That's awesome. And then a joke, it's like, you know, watching, if you have good vision, it's like watching modern, you know, videos on the internet where everything just plays out perfectly. And it's like, oh, okay, there's no hiccups.
Yeah.
Or like when we were on dial up and you'd have like that lag and like the video would stall out and then you're like waiting for the next piece to start playing again. That's sort of like what having good vision and not having good vision is that, as you just sort of said a minute ago, is yeah, if you're ready for it and you're that next step ahead, the action's already planned out. You don't need to worry about that next step. So if you're thinking that your vision is basically buffering the trail, then you're set.
I tend to like overthink it, I think, sometimes, you know, where I am wondering about that, like, how does this actually work? You know, like,
yeah.
Like I'm looking 2 seconds down the trail, and then how does my body know, like, all right, in 2 seconds, like you need to, you know, do this move. But like you said, I mean, yeah, that's a really good analogy, like a video or a laggy, like, buffer, you know.
Yep.
Yeah, like it just works.
Yeah, and like I think the biggest is like, as you say there, is like, how does the body know? So like there's reactive state and then like proactive, right? So if you put yourself into a proactive where you've already planned out this motion, then you're not in the situation where your body is having to like call up a connection and then make that connection happen mm-hmm. and then connect to a different point. It's just going through this, you know, proactive, being a subconscious. If you can see it and image it as you're going through the trail, so almost thinking of like you're watching a ghost, you know, you use another video game reference, but like old car games or probably modern car games too, they would have like, you know, the ghost that would be like the track champion that you'd follow down the track. And like, you're like, oh, that's the fast line. That's a fast line. And so like, if you can image yourself riding through that obstacle, then your body already has that sort of program set. Where if you roll into it and you just black out and go, I don't know how to do this, you don't have a preset program to go through it.
Yeah.
And so you get into that reactive state. And there's those classic riders that come down, they're like, oh my God, I just had all of these like ocean moments, right? So like those sort of moments, and that's where the rider is like every time getting just scared by everything and just going, oh my God, I almost died there and I almost died there. Right. So those are those reactive moments where you're more into that conscious action and you're just like saving yourself the whole way down, mm-hmm. you know, where you're just like, oh no, oh no, oh no. And it's, you watch a rider like that and they're not smooth. They're like ping ponging all the way down the trail,
yeah,
back and forth and back and forth. And those riders that have that pre-programmed or that planned out route. I mean, again, another great is just watching the surgical precision of World Cup downhill riders, where you just see, you like, we don't even have an idea of what those courses look like. And you just see them inches away from the edge of the tape and then cutting across and then going through these massive holes and pre-jumping all this stuff. And like,
yeah,
they're sitting at the top of that race course, like mentally rolling through that, imaging it all the way down, where they are, where's this section, where's that section. And then to take it all the way back is like with enduro, you have to be able to do that on the fly, basically, is take all of this input of a crazy trail and figure out where you're going to go. So in that part of it, you have to have the confidence in yourself that you can manage that. Right. And if you're going through it and you don't have that, that true self-confidence in your rider ability, then you're not going to be able to ride, you know, as fast as you'd want to in that blind situation.
Yeah.
And for me, that's my favorite, is riding a trail blind, you know, and trying to ride it as quick as I can. Cause I think it's a great test of your, you know, of your rider ability.
Yeah. Yeah. As mountain bikers, I mean, we love to talk about the flow state. And I think that's kind of what you're describing as well. And you hear from athletes, all kinds of athletes, not just cyclists or bikers, about visualizing and how important that is. I mean, if you're a tennis player or anybody else, it's all about that, like seeing yourself do it in your mind. And then, yeah, your body just is able to do it somehow. Maybe we don't need to overthink how that works. We just need to know that it works.
Yeah. And so I think that's the biggest part, is in that is the only way you can get subconscious action out of stuff is by practicing stuff outside of that environment. You know, you're not learning great skill by just going out and riding trail over and over and over and over and over again. Right. So like, yeah, there's those pieces. But as I said, the rider, if you don't have that self-confidence, then you're not going to be able to develop it on trail, because you're always going to be in that sort of, I don't know. But if you can take it back and actually focus on skills that are pertinent to, you know, your race run, like practicing corners in a parking lot, like going through and practicing just riding up curbs and things like that, of getting that muscle memory so that you can get that electric connection to fire correctly, instead of, you know, whatever your set, you know, motor connection is, that you're not creating that action. And it's really kind of interesting is that I think that it's getting a little bit more common, but it's not common for cyclists to practice, right?
Yeah.
You think about what other sports are out there. How much time does a baseball player play in the actual game? How much time does a football player actually play in a game? And how much time do they actually spend practicing, right? Football's out there for an hour on a Sunday, and they spend the whole week before that, you know, running practice, running drills, running this, doing that, spent, you know, we go out and we ride our bike. We're like, okay, cool, I'm getting better. But we don't actually spend any focused time on what we're doing on the bike or how the bike is moving.
Right.
We just go, more time on the bike is going to make me faster.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess most of us do tend to focus more on, yeah, sort of the endurance side of it. But you know, you make a good point. If you're a baseball player, football player, you know, you do spend some of your time at practice, like conditioning and working on strength, but much more of it is, you know, running plays and throwing balls and doing skills type work.
Yeah. Yeah. Setting it up so that you can have the reaction time, so that when the catcher throws the ball at a second, that the, you know, second baseman's in the right place to get the tag on the, you know, on the runner. So it's, yeah, we, you know, we go out there, we ride, and there's, I think that as you get older as an adult, you get less time to do stuff, and you want to use that time to do what you want to do. And it's hard to justify it. You're like, well, I'm not a kid anymore. I don't need to go play. I don't need to play on my bike. Right. But like, everybody's like, God, I wish that, you know, I wish I was good as that 14-year-old. And it's like, well, yeah, that 14-year-old doesn't have to go to the store, doesn't have to pick up groceries, doesn't have to cook dinner.
Yeah.
Just goes to school, doesn't have to get the paycheck on Monday, which is the biggest one. It's like, well, if I get hurt, I can't, you know, support my family. But and then they just go out and play on their bike, right? Like, all they're doing is just like, oh, what does this do? How does this happen? What does this do? How does this happen? You know, and they go back and forth and back and forth, and they're just sitting there. And then they're just sitting there, if they're totally into it, watching mountain bike videos, watching this videos, watching Danny McCaskill. And they're going, oh, cool. Oh, you can do that. You know, and the ones that are like super passionate about it, they go through and they do that. And then they go out for 2 hours under the streetlight and practice and practice and practice and practice. So, you know, it's the hard part is that if we just even spent 5 or 6 minutes in the garage, coming home, riding around, doing track stands, and simple basic stuff like that, you would notice a huge improvement in riding. It's you know, simple little balance drills.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, I mean, I've been riding for a long time, 20 years at least, and I've never until recently, like you said, spent time working on skills. And it's only because my son now is starting to ride, and I see what he does, you know, like you said, he loves doing that, just like messing around on the bike. And, you know, if I'm there, I might as well mess around too. And yeah, now I'm learning how to do stuff that I couldn't do before. So yeah, definitely endorse that for sure. So we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk about skills for riding flow trails, some good beginner skills to work on, and we'll talk about some of the more difficult skills to master on the bike. Stay tuned.
You can't see me, but I'm wearing an awesome Singletrax hat right now. It's actually the reason my voice sounds so amazing. Okay, so maybe not, but you never know until you get a hat for yourself. Go to shop.singletrax.com to find Singletrax hats, t-shirts, stickers, tubular headwear, and can coolers. Shipping is free within the USA, and your purchase helps support the Singletrax podcast. That's shop.singletrax.com, and thank you for your support.
All right, we're back. So flow trails are pretty awesome because they're designed so that anybody can enjoy them. So I want to ask you, Dylan, how can more advanced riders get the most out of flow trails? A lot of people poo-poo them and say like, oh, flow trails, they're not challenging enough. And, you know, I've been riding a long time. I'm an expert. Like, I don't need flow trails, but there's still a lot of fun stuff you can do if you know what you're doing, right?
Yeah, for sure. Flow trails, I mean, I think the hardest part about flow trails is they've, as a reason that they've gotten a bad rap, is that, you know, I think that they are typically judged as something with a bunch of berms and some rollers in it and super smooth. And I think that you can actually design a flow trail that can be more technically skilled, you know, like where it's, you know, might be some features that are a little rocky or rougher. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for the average sort of storybook, you know, flow trail, like, you know, we have a couple out here in Santa Cruz and Marin and things like that. It's really about, you know, just focusing on body. Like we have one locally, well, not locally to me, but where I grew up. Well, I didn't really grow up there, but I lived there for a short period of time. I sort of grew up there in a backstory, so it's confusing. But anyways, we did chainless races down it. And I think that right there is a great way to build skill, is focusing on not trying to really use pedal force to do stuff, use the bike's contact patch and your center of mass and weight to basically pump down the track, right? So using those pieces of, you know, weighting and unweighting and moving the bike and maintaining momentum. I mean, we've seen a bunch of historic race runs where Aaron Gwen's chainless win to Nico Mullally's chainless second in Worlds to, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. And it, one for me, brings in focus on, you know, movement or forward momentum maintenance, so that you're maintaining that speed, you're being as efficient as possible.
Yeah, you're not jamming on the brakes before a turn, like you're keeping your momentum and not trying to make up for it by pedaling really hard.
Exactly. And it also, I mean, if you truly do take it chainless and take the chain off the bike, you lose some of the support and stability, and you also change the way the bike rides, which is kind of a trippy, you know, especially if you're on a full suspension. You know, you're changing the dynamic of the bike, which is cool. It's good and bad. Mm-hmm. It's a really, really efficient way to sort of think about, you know, trying to get smoother on the bike. I actually, with our enduro team up here, there's a trail called Coaster, and we go out there and I make the kids ride it without pedaling. I'm like, you have to go the whole way down without pedaling, right? And so, you know, it's, some of them will get parts of it, some of them will get other parts of it. But yeah, I think that trying to ride, especially flow trails, without thinking of using your feet, you know, or using your pedals, you're still using your feet, obviously, but, you know, is really, really good for building skill, and especially for, you know, top riders. And I think that, like, cross-country riders especially, you know, or riders from, you know, a road background or something like that. I mean, trail riders too, even, you know, I see a lot of people wanting to pedal more than they need to, mm-hmm. you know, and obviously in a race run, you're trying to get as many pedal strokes as you can, you know, out there. But I myself am not a super fit rider, but, yeah, I can keep up, you know, and a lot of that is just being super efficient on the bike, is using the terrain for my advantage, you know, and all of that flow work of pumping berms, pumping rollers, unweighting, weighting and unweighting through stuff. It all transfers into terrain. You know, you look at it, just because the roller is perfectly round and manicured doesn't mean that that same bio, you know, that same body movement doesn't transfer to a big ass rock, you know, or something that's of similar feature, but more intimidating in its shape or trail, you know, trail setting or situation.
Yeah. I think a lot of people tend to see flow trails and they get away with a lot of stuff on them. You know, I mean, they feel like they don't have to use their skills as much, you know, and they don't realize though that they're not riding it correctly, or, you know, or that they could ride it a lot faster and really challenge themselves in different ways. I mean, just cause there's not rocks and roots and, you know, gnarly stuff on it, that doesn't mean that it's easy.
No, by no means. Yeah. And it, you know, it's pretty impressive. I mean, when you pick up the pace, they definitely change too. And you think about it, you know, I've seen sections of trail where I was like, oh yeah, this is fun. And then, you know, I watched like Mick Hanna roll through it and you're like, okay, I get it now. You know, and like what took me like, you know, four rollers and a turn, he took into, you know, two doubles and then took the turn and then jumped to another turn that's like right down the hill. And you're like, oh, I didn't even see that.
Yeah.
You know? So it's, yeah, the imagery of what these guys can see sometimes is pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's cool. So what is one skill that beginning mountain bikers can work on that's going to make them a better rider? What's the thing that, if you do have that downtime and you have time to practice, what could you work on that's going to make you a much better rider?
Beginner riders, if you're new to the sport, or just, you know, don't get the time out there. I think the biggest is track stands, right? Is getting to that point. Like that would be your goal, but just basic slow speed balance, you know, of going from slow movement, keeping the bike upright, keeping the bike balanced, and then eventually move into that true track stand of stopping. It's huge because it teaches you what the bike does in relationship to your body. And I think the hardest part for people is thinking is that mountain biking itself is a fluid sport, right? So your input is opposite than, you know, what it needs to be. So if you think like, if I'm, you know, balancing on the bike and I'm falling one way, it's really common for people to just push in that direction because that's pushing you away in the opposite direction, but it's actually pushing down. So if you think like, you know, surfboards, you're standing on a surfboard, or a stand up paddleboard. If you're standing on it and you have your left foot there and the board starts dipping to the left, you can't step on your left foot to push your body back. And that's
right.
That's the same thing is that with most balance work we do, and especially grounded balance work, if you start falling to the left, you push back with your left foot and that brings your body back. But if you're on a bike, it doesn't work that way. And so it's an easy thing is you start moving your body around, trying to adjust where your body is, but it's not adjusting where the bike is underneath you. And that sort of goes back to what you were talking about, that separation, separating the bike and body. And it's really thinking is that the bike is not separate from the body. It's an extension of the body. Hmm. And how you move affects how the bike is moving underneath you. So to go back to it, yeah, track stands would be the biggest. And it all starts just with slow speed. And that's, you know, there's more to it. But like the simple way to think of it is, you know, your pedal position, you can do it seated or standing. But thinking about your slow speed work would be at starting with that 3 and 9 o'clock position, mm-hmm. and then slowly pedaling just to get used to it, and then moving it into a ratchet, which would be, you know, if you think clocked of pedaling back to, you know, to bring the front foot up, you know, an hour or two. So if you start at 3, it goes up to 2, mm-hmm. and then dropping it back down past that to 4, and trying to keep that movement equal. Mm-hmm. And then slowing it down. And then the final is thinking about adding a little bit of pressure into the bars. You know, obviously you want weight off the bars in most situations so that you're, you know, supporting your mass through your feet. But with a little weight in the bars, you're actually sort of adding a little steering dampening to it, controlling the dreaded flop that everybody talks about. Oh, this bike, that bike, oh, it has flop and yada, yada. You know, is you can get the bike to track a little better. And then the last is actually like thinking, applying a little rear brake. I always use the rear brake for my track stands for practice because it allows.
That's not cheating.
Using the rear brake.
Yeah.
No. You find a lot of people will use both brakes. And if you use both brakes, it kind of locks everything out.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just allow yourself to use just the back brake, then the front wheel can move a little bit. It can rock back and forth. You get a little bit more balance out of it. Yeah. And then if you wanted to progress it, then you can move it to no brakes, you know, and then using a little bit of slope so you can use pedal pressure to get the bike to roll back and forth. And there's a lot of other body movements that are in there, and it would take me a while to walk through all of those.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, those are sort of the simple things. It's just thinking, start with a ratchet, a little bit of pressure in the hands, slowly, you know, start coming to a stop, apply the rear brake. And then making sure that your pedals, when you apply the rear brake, are trying to stay as close to that 3 and 9 o'clock position as possible.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting too, because some of the best track standers that I know are usually road bikers. So if you're a road biker, then yeah, know that you've got sort of the basic skill down and you can make the transition to mountain biking.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. That skill itself is also beneficial because, you know, the common thing is people get, you know, scared in situations. So you start coming down a steeper descent. And if you're not comfortable with slowing down to, you know, almost zero and then getting ready to step off, you're at a disadvantage there too. So putting yourself in a position where you're, you know, sort of tentative or, you know, off the back or however you want to say it, but not having the ability to stop.
Yeah.
And then step off the bike is creating an unsafe environment, you know. So even descending, ascending, you know, just rock gardens, whatever, it's helpful to be confident that you can stop the bike and get out, especially with clipless.
Yeah.
You know, it's a huge, huge piece. And then it transfers into scouting. You know, you roll up over it, you're on a blind trail, you roll to the top of a hill and you just want to stop for a second. You don't want to put a foot down, unclip. You can stop, sort of scout your line, say, yeah, I can ride that, or no, this is a good spot to stop. Or mid trail, your mm-hmm. buddy does something silly in front of you, you can stop. It's not totally blowing your rhythm. It has all sorts of little pieces. And then the ratchet itself, those moves into a whole bunch of other skills that you can eventually progress into afterwards.
Yeah, that's really cool. So which skills would you say are the most difficult to master when it comes to mountain biking?
I would say high speed corners and pretty much all of your wheel lifts, you know, anything that involves lifting the wheel and then coordinating it with the timing and everything. I think that those are your, you know, hardest skills to master because they require a lot of preparation, a lot of coordination, and then, you know, a lot of, I don't know, perseverance of actually going and following through with it. You know, it's easy to look at something and be like, oh, that's a little rock. But as soon as you start upping, you know, the feature, creating, you know, something that's visually more intimidating, then it gets in there, you know, as far as being quite challenging because you're dealing with all the pieces and then those.
Yeah, the wheel lifts for sure. I mean, a lot of people, you look at like the most popular YouTube skills videos out there and they're all the like how to wheelie, how to manual. And we see it all the time too. People are always asking for tips on how to do it. And it seems like, I mean, that's interesting that is one of the harder skills. I mean, it's not something that's natural and like, oh, you don't know how to wheelie? Like
it's, you look at it and it's, yeah, it's easy to get yourself out of balance and lift the front wheel off the ground, right? But what else do you need to do? Why do you need to do it? You know, and figuring out ways to make it more efficient are the big ones. You know, and there's so many different ways too, right? I mean, whatever you want to call it, the basic wheel lift, like your classic He-Man, just jump and pick the wheel off the ground, right? Yeah. And then you go into, you know, classic pedal wheelies and like, yeah, pedal wheelies are cool. Do I use pedal wheelies on the trail often? Probably not, right?
Just for style points though, right?
Yeah, exactly. Wave of the camera. The manual is the, you know, everybody wants the manual. They probably have, you know, some of the, I think manuals are probably one of the most kind of useful ones out there.
Yeah.
Just because they smooth stuff out so much, right? Just being able to lift the front wheel, lighten the front wheel, and get it either, you know, over something or above something is probably one of the biggest. It smooths out. So you think you have like a little trough or a little rise, you know, you roll through that trough with both wheels, you have to absorb, you know, the front wheel and then get the rear wheel to track through it. Where if you can, you know, coaster wheelie or manual across it, you can lift that front wheel. And then all you have to deal with is one wheel transferring through that. So it's, you know, I think those are kind of the best, but you don't have to be riding, you know, manual for 600 yards down a, you know, down a road, right? It's just the, you know, of the efficiency is, you know, or the needed movement is only enough to get it past that obstacle. And, you know, if you're thinking you can manual for a parking space or something like that, that's, you know, that's really all you need.
Yeah.
You know, if you could do more, you could get out there and ride with Bernard Kerr or whatever, whoever the manual Monday guy is.
Yeah. Well, cool. Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you, is anyone ever like too old to learn mountain bike skills? I mean, maybe this is a dumb question and it's really obvious, but you know, you touched on how younger kids, we look at them and we're like, man, they pick that stuff up so fast. Like I could never do that. But what advice would you give someone who feels like maybe they're too old or maybe they're stubborn? They're like, I don't need to learn any new skills.
I think the last probably is more true.
Yeah.
I work with a lot of, you know, I wouldn't say old, I would say young, old in years, but young in heart. You know, I've worked with guys in their 70s, you know, quite often. So it's really just a matter of what, you know, what you're trying to get out of it. I think that age is really just a number. You know, I feel that the kids usually aren't in a position to pay for stuff. So, you know, whether or not they need skills or not, or could benefit from it is sort of a moot point, you know, that everyone can benefit from learning a new skill or getting specific instruction. You know, as I said, the biggest thing for me, I was a pro and I was like, oh, I know everything. And I took a lesson and I was like, God, there's a lot more to this than I thought.
Yeah.
And it's the big thing is that people look at it and they're like, well, I've been riding for X amount of years. You know, I can beat all my friends down the hill, but are you doing it as good as you could, right? Or could you be better at doing it? Could you pick up something else and have more fun while you're out there? I try to do stuff out of my comfort zone all the time, you know, safely where I'm not risking it and trying to learn new stuff. Like, yeah, like I've been trying to learn stoppies and nose pivots and, you know, did I think about doing that years ago? No. If I did, I probably would have been better at it now, but there's always room to progress your skills. And I think that finding somebody to help you is going to be, it's going to make it easier.
Yeah.
You know, you can go online, you can follow all the, you know, this YouTube video and that YouTube video. If I feel that any of the sort of digital instruction without, you know, sort of either physical correction or without like a person actually watching it, it leaves a lot for interpretation where you look at it and, you know, everybody looks at a picture of a guy going downhill and they're like, oh, well, he moved his body back. And it's like, what actually happened?
You know, that's, well, a lot of those guys even have a hard time explaining it, right? I mean, a lot of them, like, I don't know, I just do it.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between, you know, going to someone that is an instructor and who really understands like how it all fits together.
Yep. Yeah. And that's for me, the biggest is just that interpretation, what people see, how they look at it, what they feel is happening compared to what's actually happening. Those for me are the things I find myself correcting the most often in lessons.
Yeah. And for me too, you know, I look at pictures of myself or, you know, doing a bike review and, you know, have somebody take some pictures of me riding the bike. And for years I'll look at the pictures and I'd be like, that's what I do. Like, that doesn't look right. You know? And you need that like outside perspective, someone to look at it and be like, you're not doing that right. You know, you're getting the job done, but there's a better way to do it.
Yeah, totally. I think that, I mean, photographs are always sort of deceiving because they can be a snippet in time where that body movement might be a correction you know, to another action. And so it may look like it's, you know, something is out of place.
No, I'm definitely doing it wrong. That's, I mean, honestly, you know, like I look and I'm like, wow, my arms are like really locked out and really straight, you know, like I need to have more bend in my arms and that's going to help me steering and shock absorption and everything else.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
Well, cool. Well, thanks for joining us, Dylan. Really appreciate it. If you want to get more information or to connect with Dylan, you can go on his website, asingletrackmind.com. That's asingletrackmind.com. You can find out about upcoming clinics and private lessons and all kinds of good stuff. That's all we've got this week. We'll talk to you again next week. Peace.